Hey, Proof listeners. Plougra's premium European-style butter is a favorite of bakers. Why? Cook's Illustrated recipe developer, Erica Turner, sums it up.
Hey, Kevin. Did you know that the kind of butter you use when you're baking can actually make a difference in how your dish turns out?
I did not.
Butters that are slow-churned, like Plougra, are easier to work with because they make doughs more pliable. The amount of fat in the butter also makes a difference.
Tell me more.
Okay, so most American butters contain around 80% butterfat, but European-style butters, like Plougra, have a higher fat content. In fact, Plougra Premium European-style butter always contains 82% butterfat.
And you're saying 2% is enough to make a noticeable difference?
Oh, yeah, definitely. With Plougra Slow Churn Butter and its 82% butterfat content, you'll notice richer, flakier pastries, cakes that rise higher, and cookies that crisp more easily.
Embrace your inner butter lover, from professional kitchens to your home. Visit Plougra.com for more information.
A mild content warning for our misophonia friends. We have some slurping and spitting throughout this episode, but not a whole lot. So stick with us. When you get a second, reach for whatever food or beverage might be in front of you. It can be anything. For me, I have a can of sparkling water right here. All right, I'm gonna take a sip. Okay, so go ahead and ingest your item of choice. Think about what happens in your mouth. What do you feel? What do you taste? Whether you noticed it or not, your body just added a key ingredient, and it might be the most important ingredient of any dish. Today, we explore the wonders of saliva. Rather than recoiling at the thought of spit, reporter Jacqueline Kim has been fascinated with how saliva influences our overall eating experience. From the moment we take a first bite, to its mechanics on our tongue, to how it might even alter the composition of our food while it's still on the table. So today on Proof from America's Test Kitchen, get ready for saliva to steal the spotlight. I'm Yumi Araki. Stick around. Reporter Jacqueline Kim brings us today's story.
Years ago, a time when I hardly thought about saliva at all, I was traveling in Korea. It was a chilly October day, and I was walking down the wet and cobbled streets of Seoul. It was just about dinner time. I could feel an angry gurgle in my empty stomach. The long trek in the rain would be worth it, though. I was about to meet my mom's childhood friend for the first time, or as I'd call her, Auntie.
안녕하세요, 이모. 어머, 어서 와.
Auntie owned a tiny but popular juk restaurant, Korean Porridge. Hers boasted at least a dozen different flavors that you couldn't find back in the States. I wanted nothing more than to toss my drenched coat and umbrella off to the side and sit down in front of a heaping bowl of chicken ginseng juk.
삼계죽 주세요.
삼계죽 맛있게 끓여줄게. 좀만 기다려.
She invited me to come right after closing hours so that we could have the restaurant to ourselves. When the juk was ready, Auntie carried over a tray generously filled with banchan, surrounding a beautiful bowl of hot porridge. There were bits of colorful veggies, soft shredded chicken, all garnished with ginseng and seaweed flakes. But then I noticed a large wooden spoon resting inside a tiny bowl.
죽을 여기 공기에다가 덜어서 먹어야 돼.
덜어 means to take less. And in this case, Auntie instructed me to spoon out a smaller portion from my own bowl of porridge into the tiny bowl and eat from there just a few bites at a time. I was visibly puzzled with this inconvenience and reacted with a, huh?
죽에 침이 많이 묻으면 죽이 맛이 없어.
Translation, if too much spit goes into your porridge, it'll change. the chuk won't be as good. This idea of 덜어, or taking less, is common in many cultures when you're sharing large plates of food. No double dipping. But I had never been told to do this from my own bowl to help preserve its taste while I consumed my meal. And I had never really thought twice about ingesting my own saliva. And what did Auntie mean by the porridge changing? I genuinely couldn't let go of that moment. Like, every time I ate chuk after that, I'd always be transported back to Auntie's porridge shop and felt like I'd be committing a sin if I didn't 덜어. So I had to find out. Can saliva really alter a plate of food mid-meal that noticeably? How could I even test this? And what exactly is this little fluid that just hangs out in your mouth all day? I know that for many of us, the idea of saliva can be kinda icky. But what I eventually came to discover is that saliva is quite the unsung hero.
Saliva is an essential fluid made by the body.
Dr. Jolie Chang, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at the University of California, San Francisco.
That's basically a fancy term to say I'm a head neck surgeon.
I wasn't really sure where to find a spit expert, but I thought the easiest place to start might be with a doctor.
You have a couple paired salivary glands on the face and under the chin, and actually hundreds of little salivary glands throughout your mouth.
And those little structures help produce saliva all day long.
But there are certain triggers that people may notice that make us salivate more, specifically any sour or acidic foods like lemon, citrus, and some spicy foods can trigger a really increased production in saliva.
Dr. Chang says that the amped up saliva production for these foods is believed to be a result of the body trying to dilute acidity or spice to protect our teeth, the lining of the throat, esophagus, and stomach. We also might notice our salivating when
thinking about a really good meal or reading the menu because your body's getting ready for that meal to come.
Unless something gets blocked in a gland.
I tell most people that I'm the plumber for the salivary system.
An obstructed gland can cause painful swelling, extreme dryness of the mouth, the inability to speak, or even eat a simple meal.
The really neat thing is one of the smallest endoscopes used in medicine is the salendoscope. Very small, thin camera, and allows us to travel down the very tiny salivary ducts we have in our mouth and project the image on a screen.
Remove the obstruction, get all that saliva flowing again, then back to enjoying food. Dr. Chang says that saliva also has
antibacterial properties that help treat and prevent infections in the mouth, prevents cavities, gum disease, and if you ever get any injuries or sores in the mouth, it helps it heal quickly.
I had no idea that saliva was antibacterial. And okay, we're getting really medical here. I promise we'll get back to food. But Dr. Chang started to get into some really fascinating aspects of saliva, as if it's this superfluid.
There's a lot of interest in how saliva could be used to detect different hormone changes or different stress level markers, cancer, and infections.
Because currently, blood tests are still the norm for much of the medical world. But if scientists could find a way to create a more advanced oral test, which is non-invasive, patients could then avoid those painful needles or embarrassing urine samples. Essentially, scientists are trying to decode saliva to reveal secrets about our health.
The very first instant a cancer cell is present, we'll find it.
That's the holy grail for Dr. David Wong and his team at UCLA. To develop a saliva test so accurate that it could detect any systemic disease in our body instantaneously.
So, people walking here.
Oh, wow. Biohazard signs.
They're very safe.
Dr. Wong's laboratory of head and neck oncology looks like the kind of lab fit for a Bill Nye episode. You enter through neon green double doors featuring two circular windows. The floors are checkered with black and blue tiles, and each research station is lined with all kinds of scientific equipment, and no shortage of plastic tubes donned with colorful caps. But way in the back of the lab, behind a protective door...
It looks like I'm in a small room with 6 refrigerators.
They are refrigerated, but they are minus 80 refrigerators.
Oh, wow.
And what you're looking at here, Jackie, is the world's largest biorepository of spit.
Cool. Right here at UCLA.
Right here. Right here.
Basically the largest spit collection.
And they are all collected using a standardized protocol.
Seeing these huge freezers stocked with saliva samples made me wonder, what's the typical amount of saliva someone produces in a day? I asked Dr. Wong when we stepped outside.
Most people produce about 600 ml. That equates to 2 soda can worth of fluid that comes continuously into your oral cavity, non-invasively, non-painfully, and non-embarrassingly.
Whether you're under that 2 soda can average or pumping out closer to 3, what's certain is that saliva is key in helping all of us to taste.
I am a sensory scientist, which means I study taste and flavor, and I also happen to study saliva.
Dr. Cordelia Running is an associate professor of nutrition science at Purdue University. She explains that saliva serves 2 major functions when it comes to tasting and digesting. 1, the physical function. Saliva coats and disperses food throughout the mouth as we chew so that things aren't getting stuck in unpleasant places. And 2, there's the chemical function.
Saliva is a solute. That's actually how I got interested in it. And so from the chemistry perspective, a solute is something that other stuff dissolves into. So in order to taste things, they have to dissolve in your saliva. They have to get through that watery mixture somehow to the receptors on your tongue.
Receptors that help us to taste sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami.
If it can't get through that liquid and get to the surface of the tongue, you're never going to taste it.
Because these receptors are hiding inside the tongue, past a tiny little taste pore. And saliva is that magic vessel that helps transport what we consume through the tiny pore to those hidden receptors. On top of helping us to taste, saliva can also help us to smell.
Pro tip, if you're ever doing anything where you're smelling something that you intend to at some point put in your mouth. So wine tastings are a great example. You know, you always see people like sticking their nose inside the wine glass, which is interesting. That's fun. Yeah, you're going to smell it. But if you really want to get a better idea of what it's going to be like once you drink it, you should inhale through your mouth. Because actually, the aromas, then they go into the air, into your mouth, but then they mix up into the air that's up in your nasal passages. And you actually smell things that way, as long as you don't have a stuffy nose.
So the next time you have a slice of margarita pizza in front of you, that's my favorite, try inhaling with both your nose and your mouth to get a fuller prophecy of what that pizza will taste like.
What your saliva is actually doing is it's going to dissolve some of those odors instead of escaping into the air. And what you're smelling are the things that get into the air. And so by changing which ones go where, it will change how it smells.
That's why there are foods that can smell great to us but taste terrible, and vice versa. It depends on how your saliva captures aroma. You know, things like stinky cheeses, fermented veggies. Oh my gosh, some dishes straight up smell like feet. But once they hit the palate, they're delicious.
That sort of smell, that smell from food while it's inside your mouth and while you're swallowing, we call that retronasal olfaction. And that's actually what most people are thinking of when they talk about how a food tastes.
Taste, flavor, smell, saliva helps with all of the above.
I have a colleague, Zhangxi Chen, who has referred to it in one of his writings as the unavoidable ingredient. And I just love that phrase, you know, that it's this thing that's going to be added to your food, whether you want it to or not.
The unavoidable ingredient. Chen's research highlights that when we eat, we're not just tasting our food, but a combination of that food and our saliva. So saliva will be there whether you ta-da or not, at least by the time a bite of food gets to your mouth. But a big question remains. How much can double dipping alter that food while it's still on the table? sitting in front of that chuk at Auntie's restaurant was probably the first time I had to be mindful about not letting saliva touch my own food. But there was a time, years before that, when someone told me that my spit could ruin a dish at a much earlier step, like when we cook.
Hi, Jackie.
Hey, Caroline.
Caroline was one of my first college roommates.
Do you have time for a random and quick question?
Yeah, of course.
So I have this like vivid memory of when you were teaching me how to make curry, like curry rice. And then we were cooking and I was tasting, and I remember it tasted good. And I was going back in for like another taste with my spoon. And you're like, ew. And I remember you like explained to me why, or something about curry, if you double dip with your spoon and like saliva gets into it while cooking, it like messes up the taste of the curry. But I don't know if you remember this.
I think I do. I mean, because we were so young back then, I think it's something that people don't know about.
Was it something like somebody taught you or you had heard?
Yeah, I remember. So my family and I, we went to a Korean Chinese restaurant to eat jjajangmyeon jjampong with the black bean noodles and the spicy seafood noodle soup. Mm. And the black bean noodles, you know, how it comes in a thick sauce. And so at the end of our meal, my dad commented on how watery his sauce became.
Ooh.
And my mom pointed out and she kind of joked and said like, oh, because you put too much spit in your bowl, in your food.
What Koreans call chim. Like, oh, chim no money or something.
Yeah. And so I asked her to elaborate on that. So I was like, what do you mean? Why would you say that to him? Mm-hmm. When you prepare thick sauces like jjajangmyeon or like curries, that's why you have a tasting spoon on the side and you never double dip in it, or else it'll change like the formula of the sauce.
I think because Caroline possessed this kind of special intel in those early years of cooking, she's always been one of my most trusted foodie friends, a true taste bud.
I teach this food chemistry class to undergraduates who are mostly going into dietetics, but there's a few of them who are going into food science and things like that.
Here's Dr. Running again. It turns out she's conducted an entire experiment with her students on what Caroline's mom pointed out: double dipping's effect on texture.
Basically, I have them lick a spoon and then stir a cup of pudding with their spoon. And it's just like a pudding pack that you would get from a grocery store for like 99 cents. But all of these pudding packs are thickened with a starch. So it's got some sort of flour in it that's used to thicken it and actually make it a pudding rather than just a liquid. But starch is mostly made of a certain type of carbohydrate that your saliva will break down into teeny tiny pieces by the activity of an enzyme called amylase. And you can see this through this experiment where you lick the spoon and you stir the cup of pudding. And some people, their little pudding cup would be like liquefied within 30 seconds.
Dr. Running's experiment confirms that when it comes to texture, saliva can structurally change certain foods in a short amount of time, particularly when that amylase comes into contact with heavy starch, like a pudding, or curry, jjajangmyeon, and juk.
Dr. Running, you basically answered a burning question I've had for the last 2 years. And I remember being like, okay, that's just something a Korean auntie would say. Like, it's just like taboo
yeah,
to,
totally
I guess, like, have
real.
Backwash.
But what about changes in taste or flavor? Would excess saliva contribute to that?
After the break, Jacqueline sets up a pretty unusual taste test. And now, back to our story.
Right now I'm making the trek over to my local wine bar, friendly neighborhood wine bar.
I wanted to conduct a taste experiment and thought, why not test this with one of the best tasters out there, a sommelier?
Monday and raining here in Los Feliz. But it's nice. Yeah, sipping on some wine on a rainy day, that's a vibe. Tabula Rasa Bar, natural wine and craft beer. I set my umbrella down.
Hey, hey
Nicole, it's so good to meet you.
It's great to meet you too. Thanks for being here.
So you guys just opened, huh?
Yeah.
Nicole Dougherty is the co-owner, beverage director, and affable sommelier of Tabula Rasa.
You're standing under the disco ball right now.
That's the first time.
Nicole has very generously agreed to coach me through a mini lesson on wine tasting.
So smooth.
In terms of just really breaking down what you're doing, it's easy to remember it's all S's. Sight, smell, swirling, and sipping. And spitting.
Sight, smell, swirling, sipping, spitting. So cool.
This is a spit bucket.
Is it like a literal spit bucket?
Yeah. So we're literally going to spit our wine in here.
Incredible.
One of the major reasons is so that your palate's not muted. It's not overloaded with the flavor of whatever that wine was. And also because alcohol will desensitize you to being able to perceive aromas, flavors, and nuances in the wines that you're tasting.
Smart practice, especially if you have to sample an average of 50 wines per week like Nicole does.
So we're swirling it. I think we've got good aeration. I'm going to put it up to my nose now. This is orthonasal, the compounds from the wine entering your nose, and then your nose, that's triggering things in your brain. And once it gets into your mouth, your saliva's activating, and it's pushing the wine and the flavor compounds back up into your nose. It's retronasal. Second smelling, I guess.
I think my glands have been activating for a while. It's so fun to watch this.
So I'll take a sip. With retronasal, you want to make sure that you are swirling the wine around in your mouth so that not only are your taste buds picking up on those things, but so that it is like physically moving its way back into your nasal passage.
That was a solid spit.
Thank you.
And so graceful. I, on the other hand, didn't have the best spit-to-bucket coordination.
Oh, that one got in my eye. At least it doesn't burn. Oh, wow. I'm almost getting the same sensation as, like, when I eat a block of, like, sharp cheddar.
Yes,
absolutely.
We sipped through three different wines, starting from light and bubbly to red and hunky. And I was struck by how specific and refined Nicole's observations were. As a sommelier, her nose is tuned to the most subtle nuances in aroma, a qualification that takes years of training and a bunch of smell and taste tests. So if anyone was going to help me answer how a little double dipping might change the taste of something, or in this case, backwash, Nicole would be the one. I was a bit nervous that she'd be grossed out by my idea for an experiment because I essentially wanted her to spit back into her wine glass this time instead of the bucket and compare that taste with a fresh glass of the same wine, blindfolded. And she said yes. We set up our experiment. Nicole chose a new bottle for the taste test.
We're going to be tasting Josef Fischer Grüner Veltliner, which is a really classic grape from Austria. I know this wine pretty well, so I'm going to try and do this experiment as fairly as possible. It's a really interesting grape.
We'll start this with the glass that is a bit fuller. You can take a swig and try to have at least some backwash.
Okay.
I can actually see your saliva bubbles floating and swirling around the top of the glass.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll wait for a few minutes, give it some time to potentially do its thing. Maybe there will be a change.
Yeah.
We'll see.
We set a timer for 5 minutes, and after that passed, I whipped out a very scientific blindfold. A black eye mask for taking naps. That's all I had.
Can we double check? Can you see anything?
I can't see anything.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to do some switching around of the wine glasses so that you can't tell. Right. Now we'll have you taste, let's call this glass A.
Nicole swirls glass A on the table, blindfold still on, without spilling a drop. Then she takes a sip. This is the glass without her backwash.
What are you tasting?
I'm tasting really ripe and bright, like a Meyer lemon. I'm tasting the white pepper that I usually get from Gruner Veltliner. I'll say I can tell a slight change in temperature from the initial pour, just because it's been 5 minutes and it's warmed up just slightly, which is allowing it to express itself a little bit better.
Great. Okay, now I'm going to hand you glass B.
Okay.
Wait. Just missed your finger. There we go. Is it a perfect swirl? Spill free.
Now she drinks from the glass with her backwash, still blindfolded.
This one to me tastes slightly broader, not quite as linear.
And when you say like broader versus linear, can you break down that a little bit more?
Sure. The way that acid kind of hits you in your mouth, and sometimes it feels vertical. And again, that's, you know, when there's lots of acid, it's sort of whetting your appetite for you want to take another sip. And then when there's less acid in wine, sometimes it tastes not quite as like zippy or zingy. And it tastes to me that I perceive that as being more broad or horizontal and coming across my palate in a horizontal instead of vertical way.
Great. Any guesses as to which glass might have been glass A, glass B?
The moment of saliva truth.
My guess would be glass B was the one that I spit the wine back into.
You are correct. Ding, 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 ding. Thus concluding our experiment. So you can remove your blindfold.
If you remember the pudding experiment with Dr. Running, we learned that saliva can change texture in a matter of seconds. And now with this wine bar experiment, we also confirmed, at least anecdotally, that saliva can change taste. But is the same true for everyone? Or is this only noticeable to a super taster like Nicole?
It does make me wonder if you're a sommelier and you have so much exposure and so much education and all of these experiences, are there differences in salivary proteins or olfactory enzymes that could be modifying your experience compared to, you know, me who I have wine occasionally. I'm terrible. I pick it out based on what's on the label. It looks like a cute dog. I buy that wine, you know, like, and so I think that there probably are pretty big differences between experts and novices.
Dr. Anne-Marie Torregrossa teaches behavioral neuroscience and psychology at the University of Buffalo.
I'm also the director of the University at Buffalo Center for Ingestive Behavior. And my lab has been interested in why people don't all like bitter foods. There's not a lot of variation in people's enjoyment of sweet foods. But a lot of people really enjoy bitter foods and others absolutely don't. And so that variation has always been fascinating to me.
She goes on to list common vegetables that are perceived by most to be bitter: broccoli, kale, spinach. And she says that certain patterns and exposure to these bitter foods can actually alter our saliva.
If you give an animal, including a human, bitter over and over and over, and they have multiple experiences with it, and it's safe, it's not toxic, it doesn't hurt them, what happens is the proteins in your saliva change, and these new proteins make that food taste less bitter. So if you eat broccoli all the time, broccoli doesn't taste that bitter. But if you don't ever eat broccoli, broccoli will probably taste pretty bad, because these proteins are not turned on in your mouth.
We have on and off buttons in our mouths that dictate how we taste food. And these buttons are further dictated by diet.
Saliva is not just changing how your food tastes in your mouth. It's changing nutrient sensing in your gut, which drives food intake decisions like meal size and how rewarding food is.
So saliva can affect how we taste bitter, which influences our food choices. But our food choices can also influence our saliva.
We have been working really hard to try to identify what proteins in saliva actually alter bitter perception. I'm a mom. I have two kids. I understand how hard it is to give kids medicine. And so we're also really interested in being able to identify these proteins so that we can add them to pediatric medication and increase medicine compliance. The most basic assertion of our lab is that when people are in, for example, nutrition counseling, and the counselor says to you, you should eat this kale salad, it tastes good. When that person tries the kale salad and it doesn't taste good, The most basic finding of our lab is it might not taste good to everybody, but if you eat it enough times, it could start to taste good to you.
I think it's so funny how, you know, this is for America's Test Kitchen. And so you have all of these very talented chefs and tasters. And I think even with like cooking competition shows, when there are judges trying food, how subjective that must be. Most of us know that people have food aversions or preferences. But now thinking about saliva, I'm like, can I trust these judges? Like when they're tasting a person's dish, like what if to me it's actually delicious, but to them, because of their unique saliva, it's not as good.
Talking with Dr. Torregrossa got me thinking back to that pudding experiment.
And some people, their little pudding cup would be like liquefied within 30 seconds. Of them licking the spoon. And other people, nothing has happened like 4 to 5 minutes later.
Here's Dr. Running again.
People's saliva is actually wildly different from one person to another. You really do live in your own sort of perceptual world, your own sensory world, one of my colleagues says a lot. And there's like real differences between what you like and what the person next to you likes.
It's almost as if we have our own unique saliva fingerprint. Learning all of this made me think, Auntie was right.
죽에 침이 많이 묻으면 죽이 맛이 없어.
Avoidable or unavoidable, saliva will eventually be the essential ingredient for every meal. Not only aiding in a healthy mouth and digestion, but it really helps to color our palate for how we experience taste, flavor, and texture. It's also something wildly influenced by our individual eating habits. But my exploration of the world of saliva doesn't end here.
It was recently Lunar New Year, so it's still feeling pretty festive here in Chinatown.
I'm in Los Angeles and it's drizzling outside. I know, more rain.
Got a bunch of the red lanterns hanging up on this rainy day. I'm gonna go in and meet my friend Fiona.
Fiona Ng, both friend and fellow audio producer.
She's the best rugs for Cantonese food and will be my Canto chaperone today. Make sure we order all the good stuff.
We're meeting up at Full House Seafood to try bird's nest soup, often referred to as the caviar of Asia. And it's kind of what it sounds like. The dissolved nest of a bird in a soup.
Bird's nest soup. It's right there. It's right there. It has its own category.
Own section on the first page of the menu.
Okay, so bird's nest with crab meat soup.
$45.95.
Wow.
But not like the twig leaves and sticks kind of nest. This kind is made with solidified threads of saliva. High up in a dark cave, these majestic birds called swiftlets will meticulously spit up a translucent, gooey substance. As that dries out and hardens, it forms the swiftlet's new home. The nest can take weeks, if not months, to be completed. And one edible pound can run you thousands of dollars, depending on the quality. The reason why this dish, or yin wo, has such a big price tag is because it's believed by many to have some healing properties, among other things.
It has such a deep cultural value. It's actually a lot of women drink it for beauty.
It's kind of like,
yes, as I understand it, a lot of women make it. A lot of women make it for their daughters, and they drink it because, I can call my mom. Because it makes your skin more youthful. That's what I heard. Oh, but you know what my mom did say when I asked? Like, she knows bird's nest as kind of like a dessert dish.
Yeah.
And then she said that, like, if you have a wedding banquet, you can actually request people to make it. That's the context that she has come to, kind of had bird's nest in the past.
That makes sense. A more celebratory food. You need, like, a special occasion.
I hadn't eaten all day, and I was so ready for the dish to arrive.
I would totally think this is just, like, crab congee. Oh, it's really hot. It's like steaming hot.
Oh, it's good.
I was just
it kind of tastes like chicken noodle soup.
It completely does, dude.
I got a piece of bird's nest. It's really? Like the clear, squishy stuff.
Yep.
I think the white stuff is a crab.
The swiftlet nest was squishy, crunchy, sweet, and it was so nice to see that saliva wasn't just the unavoidable ingredient, or even the forbidden ingredient, in this porridge. Saliva made the dish, and therefore, it deserves all the recognition.
Thanks to Jacqueline Kim for bringing us today's story. Just a heads up for listeners, we're off next week, but Proof will be back with the trailer for a special series that begins on May 23rd. It tells the story of the American cocktail in 6 parts, and I can't wait for you all to hear it. If you like Proof, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you can get new episodes as soon as they drop. And while you're there, why not leave us a rating or write us a review? It really helps other people find the show. This episode of Proof was hosted by me, Yumi Araki, and the podcast is made by the following cast of characters.
I'm executive producer Caitlin Kelleher.
I'm supervising producer Caroline Rickert.
I'm producer Alex Curran Cardarelli.
I'm associate producer Angelica Quintanilla.
I'm Sarah Joyner, the story editor.
I'm Bridget Lancaster, creator and the founding host and producer.
Audio services are provided by Ultraviolet Audio with sound design supervision by
Matt Poynton.
Scoring, mixing, and sound design by
Anya Gzeshik.
Brian Campbell of Signal Sounds composed our theme music. Additional music by Kyle Forrester and Jordan Pearson.
Jen Margolis
is our director of post-production, and our director of production is
Diane Knox.
Fact-checking and additional research by
Sarah D. Collins.
Special thanks to Jacqueline's Korean auntie for recreating that juk scene with us. Thanks also to Caroline Kang and her mom's curry wisdom. And thanks to Fiona Ang, our entertaining chaperone for Bird's Nest Soup.
Jack Bishop
is the chief creative officer, and Dan Surratt is America's Test Kitchen's CEO. Thanks to our sponsor, Plugra Premium Butter. Proof is a production of America's Test Kitchen.